This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beersmith Podcast number 56. We're in the, coming from the new Beersmith studio. We finished the great move, and now we're back online and broadcasting again. And thank you very much for listening. Quick announcement. I'm working very hard on the full version app for Beersmith Mobile, which will be available for iPhone, iPad, Android, and also your Kindle Fire. And I'm hoping to have that out within a month, and probably have details coming out at the blog at beersmith.com/blog within the next couple of weeks. So look for that article. Now, without further ado, let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Eric Schmid. He is from the Brewmeister Homebrew Shop at www.shopbrewmeister.com. Eric joined us earlier for episode 40 on Pilsners, and this week he's going to give us some tips on brewing the perfect lager. Eric, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks. Great to be back, Brad. I appreciate it.
Lagers are a fairly recent invention, right? When we look at, you know, say 4,000, 5,000 years of brewing. In fact, they think brewing may go back quite a bit farther than that now, I guess. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of lagers?
Sure. I mean, recent for me is usually what happened this morning. But in the whole history of beer, definitely recent. So, lagers really came into prominence in Germany, 16th, 17th century. A lot of them were brewed at home first. And they, you know, it was really climate controlled. And it wasn't until kind of the mid 1800s before you started seeing lagers as we kind of define them today, which were kind of the straw colored, pale colored, light colored beers. So before that, you know, they were brewing lagers before that in Germany, but they were darker. The malting process wasn't quite as refined. So the beers were a little darker in box and, those kind of darker style lager beers. But it wasn't until the mid 1840s when, they rolled out Pilsner Urquell and, with the lighter colored malt that, you know, these things that we see today that are kind of the most consumed beers in the world were really started.
A lot of homebrewers go right out and, you know, you're a homebrew shop owner, so you know they go right out and purchase a lager kit right up front, thinking they're going to make, you know, make a Budweiser or make a Coors or something like that at home. And why isn't that a great idea?
Because they're difficult to brew. and they don't leave any place for flaws. I mean, there's just... you know, some of the ale beers, especially the darker ale beers, like the porters and stouts and those, that's where I usually steer the beginning brewers if it's something that they enjoy in terms of style, because there's so much malt character to it that it can hide some flaws in your beginning of your brewing career. The lagers, first of all, if somebody comes in the shop and wants to make Bud or Coors Light or Miller, we just run them right back out.
Don't really just have anything for right? them.
Yeah. We actually have. I bought an old Hams bear, a little Hams porcelain bear piggy bank, and it sits up on the counter. And if you mention the words Bud, Coors, or Miller in the store, you have to put something in it. It's a kind of our little punishment jar.
I got friends that come over, and that's all they want to drink. And I'm like, I don't have any of that.
No, we get, you know, in all seriousness,
not to pick on them, but I mean, a lot of people want to brew the classic American lager, you know?
Well, and it's what's consumed in this country. Yeah. I mean, it's probably consumed, you know, 10, 20 to one over anything else. So, we get the questions, you know, the difficulty is that, more than anything, it's temperature control. The ability to ferment it in the, you know, mid to low 50s is, the primary reason. And then the other one I kind of touched on before is just that they're so light in flavor that if you do make mistakes with them, it's just really prominent. And so they're really light in flavor, and therefore you don't want somebody to have a bad experience right off the bat when they're brewing. So we try and set them up with a kit that, or you know, whatever kit or their first recipe that will one, be something they enjoy based on what they like, and another that's going to be easy for them to brew. And the lagers just don't really fit that category. It's we don't even have that many beer kits that we sell that are lagers, because most people have moved away from kits before they even start the lagering process.
Right.
You know, the lagering, start trying to do lagers.
Now, can you talk a little bit about refrigeration? Tell us why refrigeration is so important when you're brewing a lager.
Well, the lager yeasts are just very particular in terms of the temperature range they like to operate in. And the yeast will vary a little, but it's, you know, roughly 48 to about 54 degrees. And then you have kind of the hybrid California common steam type of lager yeast that'll operate a little bit warmer in the Kolsch yeast. But by and large, your traditional lager yeasts are in that very low 50s. And you don't, just like with your ale fermentations, you don't want them bumping up 6 degrees and then back down another 6 degrees and up. They tend to work better when they can just get set at a particular, 52, 54 and just stay there and work there. They get stressed as the temperatures change.
So, I mean, what happens if you take a lager yeast and you actually ferment it at room temperature, like we do with ale?
You get a lot of ester production.
Yeah.
Get diacetyl and other things that happen when the yeast gets stressed. Fusel alcohols, ester, the beer just won't be what you expect.
So what are some of the flavors? Cause I know a lot of people are trying to diagnose their beer, and what are,
you'll get sulfur, you'll get kind of hydrogen sulfide, you'll get diacetyl, which is kind of the buttery
butterscotch. Yeah.
Butterscotch. Yeah. And you'll get them to the point that you can't fix them because it's just so apparent. And then ester is just kind of a sharp spiciness, which is okay in your ales and actually preferred in some ales, but the whole point of brewing your lager beers are these clean, smooth lager things. So you're going to kind of defeat the purpose of why you chose that yeast or to do a lager in the first place.
So what are some practical systems for homebrewers that are trying to brew a lager? How do you put together, say, a good refrigeration system for fermenting lager? Most people don't have anything like that at home.
Right. So the problem, the essential problem is most refrigerators, you can't dial them up that high. So they don't, I don't know what the typical refrigerator is probably in the low 40s is as high as it will go.
Right.
So, you can't just turn up a fridge because it's not warm enough. And then your house and other environments, they're too warm. So you got to find this kind of 52 degrees is kind of a weird spot in terms of just buying something. So there's a couple of things. On the most rudimentary level, and we've done this here in the store before, we're here in California in the summer times, with the air conditioner on at the store here, most of the homes, most people are in the low 70s in terms of what the temperature is. We'll actually take tubs or coolers and fill them with water and then put our carboy or fermentation bucket, whatever it is you're fermenting in, inside the cooler. I mean, it has a pretty big size, decent sized vessel that you're putting this in.
Mm-hmm.
Fill it with water up to about the line where the wort is. And then we'll actually use frozen ice packs. Here, it's no problem. I get ice packs with my yeast shipments all the time. I'm trying to give them away all the time. But, the little ones that go in your lunchbox, and you take to work, you can amass a few of those. And you can put one or two of those in there and then have a couple more in the freezer. And then you just swap them out before you go to work and when you come home from work. And you'll kind of learn based on your environment if it takes, two of them at a time or three of them at a time. It kind of depends on whether you're in a cooler or the little plastic laundry tubs work. The totes you can get at Lowe's or Home Depot, those will work, although they're not insulated. You'll use a little more ice that way. We've been pretty effective at that. I mean, you've got so much mass with all the water and the wort or the fermenting beer in there.
It probably takes quite a while, right, to change temperature.
It takes a lot of time for it to go up and down. So if you can get it set at, in the mid 50s somewhere, it takes a lot of heat being applied to that for it to raise. And, just a little bit of those ice packs to go in there to keep it down. And I've done lagers in here when it's been 75, 78 degrees, and we'll just throw like four of them in, when we come in for the shift and when we leave. And we get a little bit of fluctuation, but not more than a degree or two. So that's probably the easiest way without a huge investment.
Pretty cool idea. Do you wait for the wort to get down to that temperature before you pitch the yeast? How do you handle the startup process?
Man, that's a source of debate. Some people like to start them a little warm just to get the fermentation going.
Mm-hmm.
And the downside to that is that you might get a little ester production because you're fermenting a little above the yeast range. Mm-hmm. The benefit is that you get the fermentation started and you get the benefits of it not sitting there without it doing anything, you know, of possible contamination and that kind of thing. I like to start them at the temperature that they're going to ferment at. So, you know, I would chill them however I chill them, you know, if it's on a sophisticated system and you run it through a plate chiller, just run the beer flow down as low as you can and the water flow as high as you can. And hopefully you've got cold enough tap water to get it there. Mm-hmm. If not, I would get it into an ice bath right after that to get it down to the fermentation temperature there and then pitch yeast. But I don't see any problem pitching in the low 60s and then putting it in there and letting it run down as well. But I do think you'll see a little increase in ester production if you do that.
So what are some of the differences between lager and ale yeast? I know at one time they thought they were totally different strains, right?
Yeah. And they call them top cropping for ale yeast and bottom fermenting for lager yeast. I mean, it really has to do with the amount of krausen you're going to get on top of the, on top of the fermenting beer. I mean, the lager yeast, you just get barely a little teeny bit of foam on top. Really, it's the temperature ranges they operate in. And then because of that, the characteristics that they provide to your beers, your traditional ale yeast, 68, 70 degrees for your American and British strains. And then, you know, some of the Belgian and wheat strains will actually tolerate a little higher than that and get some of their characteristics from fermenting in the low to mid 70s. And they'll create quite a bit of ester, which is part of the ale characteristic. And then the lager yeast, because they ferment so low in temperature, the ester production is down. And then part of the lagering process allows the yeast to reconsume a lot of those compounds that are created that tend to give you those kind of flavors. And by reabsorbing it, that leaves you with a kind of a really smooth, clean beer where you just let the other ingredients shine through, you know, the malt and the hops. Whereas a lot of ales, that what you're tasting is not just the malt and the hops, but you're actually tasting some of the yeast and the fermentation characteristics there. In the lagers, the whole idea is that the lager yeast doesn't really provide much in terms of the flavor.
So let's talk about ingredients for a minute. I know a lot of the hops and grains that we use in most lagers came from Central Europe because that's where the lager tradition originated. Can you talk for a minute about some of the ingredients you would use in a typical lager?
Yeah, I mean, you can use a lot of different ingredients in lagers, but if you're talking about typical lagers or the, you know, kind of the lagers that emanated from there, it's Pilsner malt that's, and if you can buy imported Pilsner malt that's grown in those regions, it's very lightly kilned, so it doesn't have a lot of color to it. Mm-hmm. Used to be that it was a little higher in protein, but the malting process has got really good to where, you know, you don't need to put them through the protein rest like you did in the past to kind of, you know, have the protein enzymes do the work on the protein.
Absolutely.
And then the noble style hops, you know, the Hallertau and Tettnanger, Spalt, Sots, those kind of hops that are low in bitterness but high in aroma are the ones that you're going to find in those types of beers because those are the flavors you get from those. They're those beers derived from that are kind of spicy and herbal. You're not getting a lot of citrus like you get in the IPAs in this country and that type of thing. But I would say that's typical of the Pilsner style beers,
right?
There's a lot of other lagers that are made in that region or were made in that region that are different. You know, Box, Doppelbox, Schwartz beers, those things that have darker malts in them. But they still tend to use those noble hops. They're not really known for their bitterness. The hops are more there for some balance and flavor.
So, I mean, what do you see in the typical German styles, though? Talk about Marzen or...
What do I see in terms of ingredients?
What kind of ingredients, yeah. A little bit different, right?
You're going to see some different malts other than just Pilsner malt. You're going to see some that are a little darker and a little toastier, like Vienna and Munich. Maybe some Cara Munich, that kind of thing, that start to round them out, give them that amber color and, give them a little more toastiness than just your kind of grassy and, gold and straw colored Pilsner style beers.
So can you talk for a minute about the concoction mashing and what that is and how that plays a role in many of these? I know it's a fairly complicated topic, but
it's not that complex. It's a source of debate in my homebrew shops all the time. You know, you'll get the brewers that start and they'll do their kit beers and the extracts and they'll move into all grain. And then some of them that have an interest in the German style beers, somewhere along the line, will come across the whole decoction method. And then I just kind of cringe when they
come in the shop. Most of us use a single infusion mash. I use a single infusion mash for probably 99% of my all grain beers, you know.
But yeah, and
but I think decoction, you got to try it at least once, right?
Yeah, at least once. At most once, maybe. But, you know, the first thing I always tell them is, you know,
why don't you describe what it is? Because I'm not sure everybody, you know, may have done it.
Yeah, I'll get there. So decoction mashing was something that back when these beers were first coming around, the malting process wasn't as refined as it is today. And so the kilning and the process the malt went through to make it available and useful for brewers, it didn't modify the malt like it is now. And so decoction mashing was a way for brewers to kind of finish off the malting process during the beginning of the brewing process.
And wasn't it also a way to get by without thermometers, right?
Yeah, because you could just boil a certain amount,
right? That's what I recall, anyways.
Yeah, so essentially, you start your mash process by coming in at a much lower temperature. So, typical decoction mashing, you're gonna have three steps to it. So the first one would be defined as kind of your protein rest. Now, some of them you might actually do an acid rest, which would start down about 105 degrees, mm-hmm. but the ones I see more often these days are a protein rest at 122. So anywhere from about 122 to 125. So you'd heat your strike water and then you would mash in and try and hit 125 for 20, 30 minutes.
Like basically like an infusion step there, right? Like most
people. So it'd be pretend like, you know, forget the rest of it right now, but it'd be like a single infusion and trying to hit 122 to start.
Right.
And then you would let that rest for 20 minutes, half an hour. And then you would essentially take a third of the mash contents out. And one of the things that's kind of confusing, I think, for a lot of people when they read about this is some of them think you actually run just the wort out. But that's not the case. You're actually going to take the mash itself and pull it out, take a third of it, put it in another pot.
This is another point of debate. Thickest part of the mash, thinnest part of the mash. I've heard people argue over that, too.
I haven't heard that argument.
Tell you oh, you haven't. Well,
I just start digging into the top of the mash.
Yeah, I know most people recommend taking some of the thicker part of the mash because you actually want some of that grain in there, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, you definitely want some grain in there. You get it too thick and you got, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit, you get the chance of burning it gets greater the thicker right. It is. So
yeah, caramelize it.
You take a third out and you put it in a pot and you turn on the heat. And you bring it to a boil. And this is where it really starts to look like oatmeal, but you've got to be stirring constantly because it'll fry on the bottom of the pan. And now you do want some of that caramelization that's going on. I mean, that's part of the reason we're doing the decoction is you get these melanoidin compounds that are created that provide color and flavor and some caramel type of flavors to it. And then once you get it to a boil, you're going to add it back to your original mash vessel, stir it in. The theory is you should be up in the low 140s now, mm-hmm. by adding a third of it back at that boiling temperature. Well, now you're at one of your sugar rests right there in the low 40s. And you're going to start doing your sugar conversion there. You're going to let it rest there I'd have to go back to my notes here, but for a period of time, 30, mm-hmm. 40 minutes, maybe an hour.
Yeah.
And then you're going to take a third out again and bring it to a boil the same way you just did. And again, you're going to get some more of that caramelization and melanoidin production, and then add it back after you've got it boiling. And again, you have to stir like crazy. And then you're going to bring it up into the kind of high 150s, which is the other end of your sugar enzyme rest. And then from there, you can run out. Some people might actually try and raise the temperature up again at mash out, just like you would on your infusion mashes. But that's kind of the step of decoction mashing. You know, in the 1800s, this was the way you got, you had to do this to get all the sugars out of the malt and actually, you know, get efficient use of the malt. Mm-hmm. The argument today is that the malts are so well modified, you don't really need decoction mashing to do that, but you'll get a lot of argument that the melanoidin production in those things can't really be replicated with melanoidin malts and things like you can when it's actually caramelizing in the pot as you're doing the
decoction. It adds some flavor or character to the beer, I guess, right?
Right, right. And, you know, out here in Sacramento, we've got the UC Davis here just down the road. And Charlie Bamforth, one of the professors
there. I had Charlie on the show several times.
Yeah, I think he just wrote an article. I haven't read it yet about, I think it was called Why Decoction Mashing is Dead. And I think the whole premise was that the malts are so good these days that it's just not really necessary for the use that it was intended for at the beginning. So decoction mashing is great. I got to the point in my life with kids and work and everything else, I just didn't have 8 or 10 hours to spend to do it.
It takes a lot more time, right?
Right. But I do think you could taste the difference in some beers if you do one way and one the other, for sure.
You know, while a lot of lagers are brewed much the same way, I mean, most of us, like I said, use a single infusion and go through the same basic brewing process. They typically go through a more complicated fermentation process, usually, you know, several steps, several different temperatures. And I was wondering if you could walk through some of the stages, some of the steps there, and why you're doing them.
Sure. I think first and foremost, lager yeast tends to take a long time to get started. So whatever you can do to try and jumpstart that process is great.
I know a lot of sources say you pitch at a higher rate. You actually use a lot more yeast, up to twice as much, I guess, as you would with an ale, right?
Right. So pitching rates, that's the first one I was going to say. Pitching rates is something of, I don't even think it's really debated. It's something where you're going to want to pitch, you know, multiple vials, multiple smack packs, if you're going to do that, or grow your own starter up and pitch a lot of yeast. The other is air. You know, you want to oxygenate well too. So that would be the first step.
And what are some good ways to oxygenate?
Well, I mean, you could do the shaking. You know, if you don't have a real sophisticated way with, you know, either pure O2 or an aquarium pump and a stone, you could, you know, shake the carboy once you've got the, you know, the wort in there.
This is before you actually pitch the yeast, right?
Right, before you pitch the yeast.
This is right after you cool it down, right before you pitch the yeast.
Right,
go ahead, sorry.
That's fine. And I've seen people pour it back and forth between a couple of buckets. That, to me, gets a little scary just because you could be contaminating there.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. But, you know, the more sophisticated ways would be to use your stone and either your oxygen or some sort of pump to actually, you know, pump some air into it. But, those are important in your ales too. I mean, I think, you know, cell count and that kind of thing and aeration are important in your ales, but they're more so in lagers and because of the lag times. You're trying to keep the lag time down really low. And I think, and I touched on earlier, I think some people will actually run the initial fermentation temperatures up a little to try and decrease the lag time too. Yeah. But I think you're going to get better results if you can keep the fermentation temperature down even at the beginning and just up your cell counts and really work on aeration. So that to me would be kind of your number one key. Number two thing about lagers is they take a while. Because of the lower temperatures, the yeast is kind of sluggish. So, you know, it'll kick off and depending on the strain, I mean, there's a lot of variables here, but you know, you're looking at 10, 14 days, you know, maybe even longer.
Just for the primary fermentation?
Just for primary fermentation. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of ales will be done in 2 or 3 days. I mean,
So that 10 to 14 days, you're just keeping it at the recommended temperature for the yeast, right?
Right. You're just keeping it at, you know, some yeast will be 52, some will be 54, some might be 50, but you know, you look at the different strain to know what kind of the target temperature.
You can find it on the yeast manufacturer page. They typically post a recommended range.
Right, right. And so, you know, that can take a little while. And, you know, gravity readings are important and, you know, watching the airlock and trying to determine when fermentation's done. But that, you're going to notice right there that your length of, well, you may have spent 10 hours in your decoction. Well, you're going to have 2 more weeks here on your fermentation. So,
I mean, that's just the primary fermentation. See, I mean, there's no big rush to pull it off the tube at the bottom, like you do with an ale, right?
No. Yeah. I mean, you got to let the fermentation go. I mean, you definitely want those cells in there doing the work. So I wouldn't be in a rush to get it out of the primary. You definitely want to make sure fermentation is done there. So, so you got this 8, 10, 2 week, maybe longer time to ferment. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that, you're going to want to take it through what's called a diacetyl rest. And this is something that the more sophisticated ale brewers will know about too, that, some yeast strains will tend to create diacetyl more than others. And diacetyl is just a compound that's created during all fermentations, but some yeasts are better at reabsorbing it quickly than others. And
we actually did a whole episode on that with Charlie Bamforth. It was quite a while ago, probably better part of a year ago. But if you actually want to learn about diacetyl in excruciating detail, Charlie's got a great podcast that we did with him on that.
Good, because I was hoping I didn't have to go through it all.
But it's important when you're brewing.
It is important.
It's important when you're brewing a lager. It's a bigger issue with a lager than an ale.
It is. And so...
So the diacetyl rest is what? Where you raise it just a couple degrees, right?
Yeah. You raise it a couple of degrees. If you ferment at 52 or 54, I'd raise it up into the high 50s, maybe low 60s. For some of the folks that have a little less sophisticated temperature control, I actually tell them just bring it in the house for a day or two. Let it warm all the way up into the 60s. It's probably not ideal, but it'll work. And the whole theory here is that the yeast will reconsume those compounds and get rid of them. If you just go ahead and crash the beer after fermentation, there's a good chance you're going to have some diacetyl in the finished beer, which you don't want. So
how long does that rest take?
A day or two.
Day or two. Okay.
Yeah. It's not very long.
And then what?
So from there, you start the lagering process, which is, cold storage. And, I try and run mine down as close to freezing as I can get it. So 34, 33 degrees. And what happens now is you're getting, the yeast is basically becoming, it doesn't have any more carbohydrate to use or to consume anymore. It's at a cold temperature. And so it becomes inactive and it'll start, falling out of solution and it's going to pull things with it. You're going to get some of the mellow, harsh tannins and those things that have been created are going to get pulled out. And then you're going to get some of the proteins and stuff that are in the beer are going to fall out of solution at this point. And the yeast will continue to consume things because it doesn't have carbohydrate to eat anymore. And it'll actually reconsume some of the sulfurous compounds and those types of things. And that's really what the lagering period is for. It's just like this giant cleanup period for the beer.
Trying to get down to that clean finish, right?
Yeah. And it's a pretty common question. It's like, why in the heck do I have to let my beer sit here and do this? But I remember the first time I ever made a lager. This was, 18 years ago, and I want to make a Foster's clone. And I made it, was real meticulous with everything, and I let it do its primary fermentation. I didn't do a lot of research first. And it went about 2 weeks in the primary, and I took a sample, and it tasted what I think a match would taste like if you were to put it in, pre-lighting it and chew it. It's like sulfur.
Yeah.
And I dumped it because I thought it was ruined. And had I known what I know now, it just needed to kind of go through the lagering process to clean itself up.
And I had that next to my question. I assume that's the DMS, right?
Yeah.
Which is dimethyl sulfide. You get a lot of these off flavors that are generated by the yeast up front. How do you get rid of them?
Time. And DMS is more of a malt thing. So DMS is something that's created if you're using under modified malt.
I guess I'm thinking of the rotten egg flavor that you get off the...
Right. Rotten egg is hydrogen sulfide gas.
Hydrogen and sulfide, okay.
Right. DMS is, is from...
the cooked corn flavor.
Cooked corn under modified malt. You're not letting it boil long enough and steam out of the thing. But yeah, H2S, and if you've made wine before, it's pretty typical in your wine fermentations to get kind of that rotten egg smell. And the yeast will actually, in the lagering process, reconsume that stuff and clean the beer up. And it's quite shocking, really, if you take a sample of it prior to lagering and and after lagering to realize, you know, what it did. And you won't have the question anymore once you do it.
How long do you lager? I mean, you're talking about a fairly long period.
Yeah, and it's, I think the yeast strains will have something to say about that too. But I would say at least a month and a half, and if you could go 3 months, it'd be ideal. So, you know, I like to brew my fall beers in the middle of the summer, so they're ready for the fall.
So, I mean, you're looking at 3-4 month process here, right?
Yeah, now you know why nobody ever wants to brew these things. The homebrewers are the instant gratification guys in my, you know, I start telling them this and they just kind of look at me cross-eyed and go, really, I'm not gonna be able to drink this for, you know, 3-4 months? Well, not if you want to enjoy it. And so, yeah, that's funny.
So one concern, do you have to worry about the yeast dying off when it's at, you know, near freezing all this time and now you want to go back and carbonate it?
Yeah.
Say if you want to bottle it, for example.
Yeah, I normally advise folks to pitch a little bit of yeast at bottling time just as an insurance policy, because it nothing worse than that. You know, you spend all this time and they don't carbonate. So I've even advised people to use ale yeast to do the bottle conditioning too, to tell you the truth. It's because it's so easy. Yeah, I mean, there's just such a little amount of what's actually going on there. Yeah. You just really want enough fermentation for the carbonation to happen. But, you know, I think having some of the dry lager yeast around or something like that to pitch it at bottle time is probably a good idea just for cost savings and storage and that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, anytime you're letting it sit cold for that long and letting it all kind of flocculate out, you do run the risk of not having enough in suspension to do the work, you know, at bottle time.
So aging cures all ills, right?
I guess. I don't feel any better. I'm aging.
Yeah. Doesn't work that way with us, I don't think.
No, I don't think so.
You know, unlike say an English ale or something like that, most lagers are highly carbonated. Why is that? And what does that add to the flavor of the beer? I mean, so a lot of them are even served in these tall glasses to enhance the carbonation.
Well, I think there's a crispness that comes from carbonated beers. And then the other thing is it helps push aromas up into your nose. You know, I know like Pilsner beers, having them highly carbonated serves the same purpose it does in IPAs.
And then they serve them in this tall Pilsner glass, like if you go to Germany or something, you know.
Right. And it just pushes those nice aromas right up into your nose. So, I think that's, you know, for a lot of lagers, but the American ones where you're not really having these, high hopping and, aromatics, I think more than anything, it's just kind of a crispness that goes along with it being really cold. That's the other thing here in this country is the beers are so damn cold. Besides being flavorless in the first place, you couldn't taste them anyway, even if they, because they're served so damn cold.
So, I mean, do you serve your lagers cold?
Yeah.
How cold do you get them?
I like to serve them the high 30s.
Oh, that's pretty chilly. Yeah.
Yeah. 38, 40 degrees.
That's about where your refrigerator is running. Your typical home refrigerator is running. So
I warm up a little bit in the glass, unless it's a frozen glass. But, if they're too cold, just any beer too cold, your taste buds don't really taste it because you just numb them.
That makes sense.
So yeah, I've actually got a Bock here that I'm sipping during the podcast here, and it's warmed up probably in the mid-40s, and it's great because you can taste everything that's going on with it.
Right. So we talked about carbonation. You carbonate it pretty well. What about water for lagers? Do you need? I mean, I know a lot of popular, you know, Pilsner and so on uses relatively soft water. Do you have to brew with soft water to get a good lager or not?
Not for a good lager. I mean, if you want to make a Pilsner like Pilsner or Kell.
Yeah.
You're going to need soft water because that's what the water's like in that region. But, you know, lager is such a broad definition of beers. I mean, there's, you know, Dunkel and Schwarzbier and Dortmunder and Bock and all these other things. So a lot of people associate lager with Pilsner because, especially here in America, the lagers here are also light colored and then call them, you know, continental Pilsners or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, Dortmund water, for example, is hard.
Right.
And the beers there are very hop oriented. I mean, Dortmunder Export is a very hoppy beer. And so, you know, it kind of depends on what style you're making. You know, I'd even argue that you could make a really nice Pilsner with relatively hard water. It's just not going to be like Pilsner or Kell. But if the whole point of a of a Czech or a German Pilsner is to have, a fairly assertively hopped, straw colored lager like that. I think the hard water sometimes can help you with that in terms of bringing out the hop aromas and the hop flavors in the beer.
Well, can you share a few other tips for brewing a good lager?
Gosh, we've gone through a lot of them. I don't know if I have any more secrets. I would just say, just like I do to any of the homebrewers, is that, do your research, but don't overthink it. Just go for it. And, the other thing I would touch on, we touched on kind of the basic, cooler-based fermenting. That will work, but it's also really easy to convert the chest freezers and those types of things with the temperature controls. It's not terribly expensive. The hardest thing is to take a traditional freezer top fridge and do it, because as you start to turn the temperature down, there's really only one mechanism controlling the freezer and the fridge.
Right.
So your freezer won't work right anymore if you're trying to run the fridge a little warm. The freezer just won't get enough cooling to keep it cold. But, you can make some great beers. You can make some great ales, but, I love lager beers and I don't brew that much anymore. And so when I do, I usually do brew lagers because they're just a style I enjoy so much. And, I just say go for it and learn from your mistakes, just like everything else.
Well, hopefully you share a couple recipes with me. I'll put them in the show notes and,
sure. Yeah, I could do that. That'd be great.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add, Eric?
I don't think so, Brad. I've gone through a lot.
I know last time we talked, you were launching a new shop.
New shop's going great.
It's in, tell folks where it's located.
It's in Roseville, California. It's northeast of Sacramento. One of the first things I did when we opened is we formed a new brew club out there. So we've got about an 80 person strong brew club called Placer's United Brewing Society. So it's Placer County. And so they're going strong and launched a new website last year that's done really well. I could always do more business.
Shopbrewmeister.com, right?
Yep, shopbrewmeister.com.
Right? And Brewmeister, let's spell it out. Brew, M-E-I-S-T-E-R. Did I get that right?
You did.
Excellent.
You did.
So things are going well for you. When are you going to open your third shop up?
I don't know, but it's going to happen. It's going to happen at some point. I got to stop coaching T-ball and everything else, so I have enough time to do it.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. I'm glad things are going well for you. And today my guest was Eric Schmidt. He's from the Brewmeister Homebrew Shop. You can find them online again at shopbrewmeister.com. That's shopbrewmeister.com. Thanks, Eric.
You're welcome, Brad. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to give a big thank you to Eric Schmidt for appearing on the show. Really appreciate him being here. I do apologize for the delay between shows there. We missed a couple episodes in February because we were moving studios. If you want to see a little bit about what the new studio looks like, you can join us on YouTube and you'll see at least parts of the new studio in the background there. It's a little bit nicer than the old one. I'd like to remind you, if you haven't signed up for our newsletter, you can go to beersmith.com and fill in your email address on the right side where it says newsletter. And I will send you an article that I wrote on homebrewing every single week. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.